Yes.
Put it on there.
We'll print it out. What do you make? This is a new video, so they have.
Oh, it's a new movie?
Like 20 copies.
I did.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm.
So those are ready to go.
Well, there was a big car.
Actually, I wonder if I might have.
I don't know.
I saw a big car last year. I had it, but you may have done it, so.
Yeah, but nobody's coming.
That's business.
Yeah, that would be really good. And that's what's on this thing. It's called.
Right. So it's more. Here, the end of the building.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking to bring an umbrella, and then I realized that I was going to be in the parking garage, so I don't have to get outside. It's a beautiful thing.
Glad it's done.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Slept almost all day Thursday. It was a tough session, and it's just always grinding at the end anyway.
Yeah, the last party that he did.
Interesting, isn't it? I had teacher tenure, and that was tough. Because it was tough on the B side, we were up till 2 in the morning on committee and that.
I'm sure you're
aware. Enough is enough.
Wouldn't let him get away with it.
Great line.
I love it. Oh, that's really good.
Everything has been said, but not everybody has said everything. That evening, and that's something I think everybody had to say.
And then they said it again on the floor. That's what was interesting, and my job was just be there for my side and not be controversial. You know how that goes.
Enough already.
No more.
Hi, you're Mickey.
Mickey.
That's right,
yes.
Joe.
Yeah. Good to see you again.
Did you do your homework?
Yeah.
I'm trying.
Welcome.
And you?
Whenever I have any. Delighted.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hey, Ernie.
They already have them.
That's great for movement.
I'll wait till Chuck gets here.
It's true. Those are the disasters. Oh, absolutely. People said, I'm never going to go to the polls.
Hello, and welcome to the Best Practices and Vision Commission meeting for May 18th, 2010. I'm going to do a couple of inside baseball issues real quick. If everyone could turn on their mics and leave their mics on. For the everybody's on, everybody's good?
Green light.
Yep, green light. Keep green light on. Green light go. So. Last time we had some audio difficulties with things not being dropped and couldn't be heard on the internet, so we wanted to make sure and keep all that active this time. Does anybody need a copy of the agenda? I can hand out extras here. And we actually had a new version of the agenda with one additional item and a couple of little tweaks, so I can hand those out if I have those copies. I think maybe, Sherry, do you have those copies of the extra agenda? Oh, well, then I have them. One of my piles here.
Let me see if you left them by the printer.
That's yours. Well, I don't think I would have. Okay, well, anyway, we'll get to that here in a moment. The secretary wanted to make a quick introductory remark, and then we'll get to the other items on the agenda.
Thank you, Judd. I'm Bernie Buescher, Secretary of State, and I want to thank you all for being here today and working with us on a couple of these very important projects. Let me just cover a few somewhat housekeeping items.
We're going to tee up over the course of this period of time a number of issues for you to look at and to consider, and we're doing that with a hope that at the end of the day we can get recommendations from you. I'm still hopeful of getting a couple of additional members for this commission, because I want to make sure that we've got all of the appropriate diversities, and frankly we haven't covered a couple of things yet. So we're still working on that, and there may be another member or two that I'll ask to join the commission over a period of time. As you look at the issues that we tee up for you, I think the challenge is going to be this. It's very easy to get lost in the details with some of these issues, and at the same time, step back and have a good enough view to make a good recommendation. I think often about the time I spent in the legislature, and the best person I ever worked with that could balance that was Tom Plant. I was never as good at it as I would like. I probably had a bit more tendency to get lost in the details of how you make something work. That's important, but I think your bigger job is to give us a vision, and that's why the title of this commission is Best Practices and Vision. So I would just urge you, as you look at these various details, we'll give you as much information and work with you to bring folks to testify. We'll do as much of that as possible, but I would urge you at the same time to try to stay a bit high level. We're going to have some good discussions today, I hope, about where we're going as a state with the way that we run elections. And as you know, in last year's legislature, one of the proposals that was discussed, never became an actual bill, was moving Colorado to an all-mail ballot state, an all-mail-out ballot state, mailing out ballots. The method of delivery back was still with a number of variations. Obviously, that was driven a lot by cost, but it's also driven, I think, by some perception that that is the choice that the citizens of the state are asking for and making. That doesn't necessarily indicate that that has to be the right decision for Colorado. I'm just saying that as an indicator of what I heard and what I perceived. So, again, thank you for your work. I'm going to be sitting here most of the day just taking notes. But with that, Judd, I'll let you go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Ms. Secretary. We want to introduce one new member. That's Rich Pelletier, who is here with us. Rich, do you want to do a quick 30-second bio of yourself?
Sure. Rich Pelletier. I'm with America Votes. I'm the national program director, so we spend a lot of time thinking about election reform issues across a number of states. But I live here in Colorado, and this is my home and where I work out of, so I'm pleased and excited that I was invited to serve. So thank you.
And what part of Colorado are you from?
I live in El Dorado Springs,
Boulder County,
south of Boulder.
Well, welcome. As the Secretary suggested, we have a couple of other people who we're talking to about joining as well, so that we'll have news on that shortly, and we'll probably fill out the commission at about 15 or 16 members, as we always intended. So that's news on the next agenda, I would imagine. Our first topic today was to go ahead and finalize the what I'm calling bylaws, but are really better described as standing rules of procedure. You may have brought the copy that I provided via email. Does anyone need an extra? I have a couple of extras here. As you can see, I made many of the changes that were discussed in the last meeting. Does anyone else have any topics about that that they'd like to bring up? Yeah.
Yeah, ahead, just the last sentence about the minority report. Should the minority of commissioners wish to, they may prepare a minority report of the commission. I just wanted to propose that we use the same model as last Electoral Reform Commission. When they produced this, they included the dissenting views along with the consensus views in one volume,
mm-hmm.
Rather than putting the burden of producing it if the minority wants. So I motion that the last sentence include an accommodation for the minority report being included in the final report.
Does anybody have any comments on that?
This is Ryan Call. I'd concur and just maybe recommend that we add the language at the end of that sentence for inclusion or for publication in any public reports. Does that work?
Sounds great.
Do we have a preference on wording for inclusion or for publication?
I did submit a line that to Judd, I think yesterday or earlier today. Mm-hmm. That has that, I could look it up. Should I?
I think as long as it conveys the idea.
Yeah, that's this, it.
Any other comments on that? Okay, so with that change, which I can make, can I get a motion to vote on the final rules? Or
So moved.
Seconded. Good. Standing rules of procedure. All in favor of accepting the revised version with the addition that Joe Ritchie has proposed, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Okay. We will make that change, and I will put that as a publication on our website for which, like I say, I think I've told you individually, but I'll say publicly now, our website is in construction, but will likely be up as early as today. I know they were working on it today, and it may be up very soon. So I'll put this and any other materials that we use today or in past meetings and future meetings up on that website. Okay. Now we were going to get to some of the major topics that the Best Practices and Vision Commission was going to address. And the first that we put on our agenda was a discussion of statewide mail ballots, since that was the most current point of interest among policymakers in this last legislative session. So we've asked that a couple of people come and talk to us today about the idea of an all statewide mail ballot. You'll remember from last meeting that I passed out a quick summary of the cost or projected costs of mail ballot in the state of Colorado with that was collected by the county clerks and was submitted to our office, to the Secretary of State's office, for further our understanding of the potential savings that would accompany an all-mail statewide ballot. And the person who compiled that is Russ Ragsdale, who's the county clerk and recorder for Broomfield County. And we've asked him to come here today to both discuss his survey and then also to tell us any other insights that he has into the effect that statewide mail ballot would have. So I'll ask Russ to come up and tell us what he has to say, and then we'll give him some questions. By the way, he gave me, right when we were starting, he gave me a copy of the survey instrument that he gave to the counties for them to collect the information. Russ, do you want me to pass that out now, or do you want me to hold it? I will pass it out now, then. I also have extra copies of the last time where we collected the information on the other counties. So let me, and I have enough copies for everyone both ways, so feel free to grab a copy for yourself.
Okay.
Judd, if you don't mind, as you're passing that out, I'll just give you an introduction to who I am. Russ Ragsdale, the city and county clerk for the city and county of Broomfield. Been involved in election administration since 1982. Yeah, I understand. I don't show my age, but it has been a while. I am serving as a co-chair of the Election Statute Review Committee. It's a subcommittee under the Clerks Association, Colorado Clerks Association. In that capacity, we completed this survey in January, February of 2009. Following the general election in 2008, there were assumptions made by a majority of the clerks that the general election in 2008 was the most expensive election we had ever run in Colorado history. There was also assumption on the part of some clerks, some percentage of the clerks, that had we operated that election as a purely mail-in ballot election, it would have cost less. So the Election Statute Review Committee took upon itself the effort to try to identify what those costs were in the 2008 general election and to ask each clerk to accompany those costs with an estimated cost had they operated the November election as a mail-in ballot election. So the survey was sent to all 64 counties, and you now have a copy of the instrument that was distributed to those 64 counties, and it gives you an idea of the components that we broke the election down, common components among all counties, and we hope that it provided enough information, enough background, the counties would have a good idea of identifying what those specific costs we were looking for, what those were. It's always been my experience that when you're conducting a survey with 64 counties, especially when it has to do with finances, that if you're not very careful and very specific, you get responses all over the place. So we try to narrow these down into some specific components, and that what you have in front of you is our effort. We heard back from 48 of the counties, so we had roughly a 78% response. The counties were asked to provide real costs supported by invoices. Now, this was very shortly after the November election, and so we felt at that time we had a good opportunity to get real costs, costs that counties would have invoices in hand for what it costs to print ballots or what it costs to rent facilities or what have you. They were also ask, like I said before, to go back through those same costs, those same components, and identify what they would have expected to have spent had it been done as a mail-in ballot. Now, obviously, that was some guesswork, and we asked the counties to do their best effort on that. After submitting the surveys back to me, after coming back with those survey responses, we did, and the chief deputy in Boulder County helped me a lot on this, and so did several of the members of the SRC. We got back in contact with some of the counties, because quite honestly, when we got responses back, some left some vagaries, shall we say. So we contacted the counties and asked them to explain where they came up with these figures, if they had invoices supporting that, could we see the copies of it, and just recalibrated some of their responses. Most of it was just a matter of an explanation. Why certain costs were the way they were. We did not get back to every county. We did not solve every question that we had about the survey. One other thing that, as you're looking at this, I understood you did discuss this at your last meeting and how it applied to mail-in ballots mail-in ballot elections as we know them today with the current state of legislation. One thing I do want you to understand that in 2009, when we conducted this survey, we did not ask counties to provide us cost estimates for service centers and drop-off locations. Those were not contemplated in the survey for estimating mail-in costs. In addition to that, though, there were costs we didn't identify, such as amortization of election equipment, cost of storage facilities for that election equipment. We did not ask that to be included in there because that, frankly, is truly all over the board from county to county. So with that said, I'm really here to answer questions. I understood there were quite a few questions about the survey and the information, so I would be more than happy to try to respond to those.
Anybody have anything that pops to the front?
Hi, Russ. This is Stephanie O'Malley from Denver. I just wanted to kind of share with you what my comments were in the last meeting relative to a survey like this and some of the challenges, as you just mentioned, that come about when asking information from 64 counties. My comments in the last meeting were offered in the spirit of trying to find some consistent way in identifying costs associated with the different types of elections models, whether they be mail-in ballot or polling place or whatever that is. And as we know as county clerks, sometimes those costs are identified in different ways, simply because of the manner in which each county decides for themselves how to put those costs down on paper, account for them, whether it be amortization over time or a one-time cost up front that they're putting into their calculations, whether they're including, you know, whatever the category may be. And I know in the survey that you sent out, there are several categories on there. But I think what's important in moving forward in this discussion about, you know, mail ballot activity and cost across the state of Colorado is trying to capture at least some consistent categories where there can be some fair cost comparisons across the 64 counties, okay? Because there's absolutely, from my mind, in my seat that I'm sitting in, there's no way that we're going to be able to have a real conversation about costs if we're not being careful about how those costs are being captured and we're not being consistent about how those costs are being captured. So, you know, while I respect the numbers that are presented here because every county responded to you in the way that they believed was appropriate, I'm not confident that that translates into everybody was reporting in a consistent way the type of information that this commission needs to have in order to have real, true data relative to cost for the state of Colorado. That's, you know, what I would like to offer.
I certainly wouldn't dispute your statement. Again, hearkening back on my experiences in doing surveys with counties, especially fiscal surveys, and I see Ms. Wadhams here, and I think we share a common experience there when we attempted to do some research on prorating costs back to special districts and municipalities from, and I don't want to pick any scabs here, but that's a sensitive subject, but we did a similar issue and tried to, or similar process in trying to identify common costs between counties that run elections in varied and different ways. And so we had some fairly recent experience in that, and I'm not going to argue with you. I think, but I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how to go about that to produce the kind of figures that you're looking for that would be irrefutable. I just don't know if that's possible, certainly with the limited resources that we had at the time, whether that was feasible. I think I will say that there was no report that was developed to accompany this aggregation of results. There were no conclusions drawn from it. It is simply a collection of data as submitted by the counties. You can, I think, reasonably use it to look at trends, to get a general idea. Whether I would be comfortable to take it in front of the legislature and say we could save X number of dollars by doing this, you're not going to get me to do that. So I don't know what that leaves you with. I think it was a good effort. I think it was as good an effort as we could have made at the time, given the resources. I say we didn't draw conclusions from it. It is what it is. So.
Thanks, Russ. Carol Murray. there aren't any headings on here, so I want to confirm this. These numbers are from the 2009 election, correct?
The November 2008.
November 2008.
Right, the presidential election in 2008.
Okay, so that was the general. And so the actual cost would have been the polling place cost, correct? And the estimated would be the mail-in ballot?
Correct. You'll see in the large spreadsheet, I think you had a copy of that the last go around. Under each county, there's two columns, PP for polling place and MIB for mail-in ballot. So the polling place were what we tried to capture as real costs, again, supported by invoices. The MIB or mail-in ballot were the county's best estimate at what those components would have cost in a mail-in ballot election.
And I should say, Russ, that while we don't have that full Excel sheet here with us, I can certainly forward that to everyone or make it available. It does, as Russ pointed out, it breaks down each county by these subcategories.
My apologies. I thought you had that at the last
meeting. Well, we had this, the aggregate, which is the listing of the different categories.
Okay. I'd be more than willing to share the by county breakout.
This is Pam Anderson. I'd like to sort of talk a little bit about, you know, I think the Secretary talked about the level of detail and the comfort with data and might be under that topic, but I would like to point out that variable is not the same as refutable. I think when you're collecting data in a state such as ours, where variability is the day-to-day operation of elections administration because of the variability of our systems, because of the variability of our type of election, because of the variability of polling place versus vote center versus that the data is going to produce variability in cost, period. And it's not, I don't think it's fair to define that variability is the same as refutable. And it's important. I mean, it's just what it is. One of the things that I liked about this survey and when it was identifying the detail for, I think, a lot of operations, that these were invoiceable metrics where you, or a budget line item that you could point to. For example, the variability comes in how do they identify budget line item versus invoicing. And so without getting bogged down into that level of detail, I do think that you can look at it and this ongoing need for the same to be valid, which I see a lot of in testimony and when we're collecting information on positions or I think there has been a lot of pressure on elections administrators that if it is different, it must be an invalid from your neighbor to the next neighbor to how they do it here. And I think it would be important to step back and look at it that it just is, and that when you're collecting data, that it being different doesn't invalidate it.
Carol Murray again. I would add to that another metric to look at perhaps in the future, Russ, might be to just get the information from the counties that do mail ballot and then polling place one after the other. It's very clear the difference in cost. I know when I was a county clerk that you say, oh, well, the reason it was so expensive that year was because that was a polling place election and the following year was a mail ballot election. So those would be some interesting numbers to see, too.
That would be a good comparison. I agree that, unfortunately, as I'm sure you well know, I mean, there are differences from a coordinated election in an odd year, from a general election in the following year. Just turnout alone drives a significant difference. There's a lot of factors involved. It's not generally as easy as just comparing one county to another or one election to another if they're not like elections. And I don't know that we've ever had a like election to the 2008 presidential. I think that was, hopefully, that was unique.
Hi, Stephanie O'Malley again. I agree that I don't think there's any disagreement that, with the exception of a couple of counties that was noticed on the document that we were given, that mail ballot elections incrementally from a percentage standpoint cost less than a polling place election. I don't think there's a lot of argument to that, generally speaking. I think in this discussion, though, again, in moving forward relative to a platform across the state where everyone potentially could be engaging in this type of election in an even year, in addition to the odd years, it is what do those costs look like in an environment where we have to talk about servicers, how many of those, connectivity, transportation in terms of picking up ballots if counties so choose to do so throughout the day. Those are the cost factors that I don't think historically, because we haven't implemented the type of environment that we're talking about implementing now moving forward, that really have to be taken into consideration from, county to county, the small, the medium, to the large. There's absolutely no way that a county as large as mine, I can just speak for Denver, and those that are analogous sizes, could operate with a minimal amount of service centers. I wouldn't be able to serve my voters in an appropriate way. Now, another county that doesn't have that kind of challenge, their cost is going to be very, very different, because perhaps they can manage an election with one or two service centers without having to outfit a location that is totally, at this moment in time, not prepared to have T1 lines or to host any type of election activity. So it's not just this conversation of paper and postage, although those things are important. But I'm saying moving forward, we have to capture exactly the categories within which we know there are costs or there could potentially be costs to carry out this type of election.
I would, if I could respond to that. I think that was the effort we made with this, is to try to identify common costs across 64 unique counties. We did try to do that. Whether we succeeded or not, you can certainly be the judge. One thing I will say, Jeff, you called me earlier today and asked me if we were looking at the same numbers, and I said, yeah, sure. I don't know that we are. I just saw the summary report that's sitting in front of you, and I'm not sure what the pedigree of that is. That's not what I'm looking at.
It was where that came from was the larger spreadsheet, which delineated all the categories, had these sub-spreadsheets on it, which divided them into above 100,000 registered voters, between 100,000 and maybe 25,000, and 25,000 and below.
All right.
I believe.
Gotcha.
And so I think they're the sub-parts or the sort of
the detail, right?
The aggregate of the detailed ones.
Thank you.
So then the most detailed description, this is Joe Ritchie, the most detailed description of the survey is this document here?
That document was used to collect the information from the individual counties. That was distributed by email, and there's some helpful tips in there of what specific items we're looking for by category to report. Actually, what I'm looking at here is a spreadsheet that lists every county. Actually, I'm looking at a blank screen right now. I think my battery's dead. That means I have to go sit down. It will list the responses back, dollars for every category by each county that responded. And I'll send that to Mr. Shoten.
We'll get a copy.
I'm happy to share that with you, yes.
Yeah, no, that would be really helpful, and really to determine what areas of cost maybe were not covered or not asked about. You mentioned, service centers aren't covered, the storage of ballots or storage of equipment isn't covered, the cost of mail drop-off boxes not covered. If we had a complete spreadsheet of that and then were afforded the opportunity to add to it and break it down for more detail, the next general election would provide an opportunity to gather with a new cost formula to gather more complete data. And I just wanted to know what other areas you can think of off the top of your head without the aid of your computer that should be covered in a new cost formula.
Actually, I would love to sit down with you and work through that with the details on that, because we do have some ideas. Let me give you an example. We have one particular component here under rentals called election equipment. we had responses back from some counties who rented election equipment, and they had an invoice. It was a real hard cost for that specific election. How do you compare that when you have another county that has purchased their system and has, under purchase, adequate equipment to run that election without an amortization of that equipment included? So there was a, you may call that a flaw in the survey there. We had some counties reporting rental while others didn't have rental, but they didn't have the means to report the cost of their equipment. So there's some details in there we did learn from this that I would be more than happy to work with the commission in any capacity to improve and enhance this. So.
And I was curious, that there's one county where the costs were like $35 a voter, and I wondered if the cost breakdown would help identify where too much money was being spent and where they could trim the fat, as they say. If the new cost formula would be designed to be able to do that, so there could be cost savings found there.
A lot of that goes back to Ms. O'Malley's comments there, too. It's the clerk's best guess at how to serve their constituents, and there is a little bit of forecasting that takes place prior to an election, and I know there was a lot of forecasting going on before the 2008 presidential election. You know, what is going to be the percentage turnout we have by mail? What is the percentage turnout we're going to have on election day? How do I staff my vote centers or my polling places? How many early voting sites am I going to need, and how do I staff those? And that's, and I think what you found in the November 2008 election was a lot of over-engineering on the parts of counties. So when you say about trimming the fat, I wouldn't argue with that, and I think maybe this is a tool to identify that, but I know a lot of county clerks that know very well where they could trim the fat simply because they over-engineered not knowing what was coming. With the three major ways of casting a ballot that we had available in Colorado in 2008, where do you put your eggs? Where do you put your resources? Which basket? And a lot of us chose to put as many eggs as we possibly could in every basket.
Carol Murray again. Yeah, that is really true. You tend to err on the side of doing too much rather than too little because you get slammed otherwise. I do know about that. But in terms of what is not in these numbers, I would say the things that are missing are probably the expenses that come from a polling place election, the cost of the equipment, which is much greater than if you have a mail-in ballot. I mean, it's just intuitive to know you don't need as much equipment if you have a mail-in ballot. And the other factor, the biggest factor, is just like a school district, you know, your biggest expense is your payroll. It's your election judges. So if you have 300 polling places and you have 5 people to 10 people at each polling place, that's a huge expense compared to, you know, 10 service centers instead with a mail-in ballot. So it's a people cost that are the huge numbers, and that's why it would be valuable to see just one county sort of summary of their expenses, because then you could get a real feel for that.
Question to the clerks here. If cost is the primary criteria, would the data collected allow us to determine, say, a precinct polling place election on election day only would be less expensive than early voting, mail-in voting, and precinct polling place as we do now, this hybrid form? Could we determine that election day precinct polling place elections are the cheapest way to go?
You could forecast, for example, expecting that, like one of the things that we do in forecasting with turnout is we look at ballot content. How long does it take to vote the ballot on the equipment, on a paper ballot? The different mechanisms to do that, how many judges you have there, how many people can you process through the precinct in your 12-hour time span? And you would have to do forecasting if you were going to shift everyone to the precinct on election day, and it would require a fair amount of forecasting to do that. Of course, making the assumption that there's not a revolt from your voters by doing that. And so, you know, the number of polling places, it would change the existing system to a great degree. So we could tell you what the cost is for our existing precinct or vote center or early voting site with respect to paper, you know, the number of paper ballots that we put out, the personnel, the equipment, so on and so forth. But if you're going to change the election system itself, it would require a lot of forecasting.
Mm-hmm. Just to be understood, the concern with the loss of precinct polling places and the people component, as Carol has said, is that we lose the civic participation of the public and the ability of citizens to oversee the election on the ground in the neighborhoods. And by going to this more centralized method of voting, the people are cut out of the process. That's a concern I hear a lot.
I'm just curious. This is Judd. I'm just curious. Do we know what's the average amount of time, length of time, that people need to actually vote the ballot? Do we know? So let's say an average county. Let's say your average county in a presidential cycle with all of the ballot initiatives and so forth. What's the average time it takes to vote it?
Garland,
I look at the county.
Garland Wall, Washington County. I would say an average of 10 to 15 minutes, and that's if they're fairly well prepared when they go into the voting booth. And a lot of the counties mail sample ballots, so they can be prepared when they go to the polls. But I would say average 10 to 15 minutes per voter.
Yeah, I think that's a good. Again, you know, you start measuring it. It may be variable. For example, for the electronic equipment, based on the screenshots and how many, you know, passes through and everything. But I think that's a pretty good estimate in a really long ballot environment. It was on average 25 minutes to negotiate the two-page double-sided ballot in Jeffco in 2008 per voter.
I have another question for you. I noticed that a couple of counties on the aggregated spreadsheet showed a negative cost. So they showed that a precinct level or whatever current method they were using as opposed to a statewide mail ballot would be actually less expensive than a statewide mail ballot in their county. Is there an obvious explanation for that, some criteria that we can see across those counties that explains that?
I'm going to have to guess a little bit. I did talk to some of the county clerks who responded that way, and it seemed to me, Judd, that it was the amount of preparation, the amount of risk avoidance that particular clerk or that particular county was willing to engage in. If what we saw is, and I encountered this when operating vote centers, I ordered well over 100% ballots for my voters. And that was driven by vote centers, because voters can show up at any location, and I have very little history to go back to, so I have to have a well-stocked inventory at each one of my locations. So some counties, not only in vote center counties, but other counties, ordered a surplus of ballots, if you will, and they felt that ordering... I'm probably talking backwards here. It depends on what kind of risk assumption a county would take. Some counties tried to order down to the very minimum amount, and if they were using a traditional precinct, they were able to do that better than a county doing a vote center, for instance. And when you're doing a mail ballot election, you're going to order at least 100% for your active voters. So it may, in fact... If that's the most significant cost you have in your election operation is ballot printing, and we did encounter some counties not only pay just for the printing of the ballot, they also pay for the printing of the associated material, instructions, the envelopes, the insertion and assembly of the package, and the mail service. So they talk ballot packets rather than ballots. And some counties actually have ballot packets prepared for walk-in voters, and some just have a ballot, while others the cost of mailing it out would have been a lot more. Others, it wouldn't have. They had to order more ballot packs. I'm really nailing this answer, aren't I? I have no idea, Judge. I can't wait till the next time we do the survey. It's a matter of how a county prepares their ballots or how they order their ballots. If they order for a walk-in ballot at 130%, mm-hmm. It was surprising to me to see that cost of ballot printing was less for a mail-in ballot. And conversely, you may have the other way around, where a county tries to nail it down to the absolute last voter, how many ballots they order. And when they looked at the estimate for mail-in, they ordered not only for all of their active, but their inactive, too. Mm-hmm. So you had variance there.
Yep. We'll do
Garland Wall. Just expand a little bit on what Russ is saying. In my county, I can print my own secrecy sleeves that go on the ballot. We do our own mailing, but your larger counties don't have the personnel to do that, so they have to hire some of that done. So getting that comparison, it is very difficult, and I think that's what Russ was trying to say made it hard for him to compile all of these consistently.
Thank you, Garland.
Yes, I'm Kevin Paul. Just so I'm clear, on this survey, the level of detail that you were describing wasn't actually collected empirically about the counties and included in the results that you're working with here. Is that part of what you were describing as the next steps of a survey that you would want to conduct?
No, actually, it was collected empirically for the polling place elections. Again, those were real costs that the counties expended. I think back to Judd's question, was the difference between counties. Some showed a greater expense for a projected mail-in ballot cost versus the real cost for a polling place, while others showed a much a cost savings in doing the mail. And I think that gets back to your question, doesn't it? Did I misread? Why some counties projected a savings and some projected a greater cost?
Okay.
Again, it goes back to the individual county and how they and back, Joe, to your comment earlier. One of the things we hope that we could use for this too is to identify where some counties, and I hate to say this, but some counties are paying a premium for their contractors. And we had hoped that some of this information may point them in a direction of a more competitive pricing.
Rich Pelletier, I have two questions. The first is, has anyone attempted to look at maybe a county that has done an in-person municipal off-year election and the next year done it as a mail-in ballot election and kind of look to see in that two-year period how costs were affected? That might be more of a comparison of apples to apples, and I'm not sure if that's been done.
I think this goes back to Ms. Murray's point about doing consecutive year studies and going from a general election where you do it in a more traditional sense versus a coordinated election that's conducted all mail-in ballot.
I'm talking like I'm thinking of Denver. 2007 was an in-person municipal election. Is that correct? No, was all mail as well. So maybe there are no comparisons. I'm not sure if there's a county or some counties that had done that more recently that you could compare that year. That off-year election to the immediately the next off-year election, but maybe that's not. Maybe the data is old as well because that's happened for a while.
One thing we have found it is, and that's one of the reasons that we were driven to do this in January of 2009, and we actually started this in December of 2008, is to try to keep it as close to the event as we could,
mm-hmm.
because it's much easier for counties to assemble good, accurate, reliable data than to have to go back 2 years. So I think your point's well taken. In fact, I'm thinking of Broomfield. In 2007, I ran a vote center, a traditional walk-in voting election in the coordinated election, and a mail-in ballot election in 2009. So I should be able to do that. The thought of going back to 2007 and reconstructing the cost there, might be able to do it. And it might be worth the effort.
Well, and I guess to kind of add onto that, well, and maybe this primary election might be a perfect opportunity for us to start thinking about that. If folks are going to be doing for the first time a primary election, that's an all-mail ballot election, this might be an opportunity to kind of get ahead of that election and get that data. My second thought was maybe it would be helpful. It would be helpful for me, and if folks disagree, that's fine. But, Russ, if you could maybe just maybe take us through the Broomfield piece of this spreadsheet and just kind of talk about how you came to your mail-in ballot numbers and kind of what your thought process was going forward. I think that would help me understand maybe what went into this. I'm sorry, no one has this spreadsheet but me?
Mm-mm.
Sorry. Can we put it up?
It's basically the elaborated version of the aggregate. So. And maybe we could put it up, actually. It's on my computer. Let me do that real quick. Talk amongst yourselves.
Chuck, while you're doing that, like the microphone, I will finally get out of your way.
I think it's this door here.
I was just sitting back here thinking, how do we get the level of information that I'm clearly perceiving that you would like to have? And I think there are a couple of ways that we could go forward. One is that, well, the obvious step is that we need someone with some independence who can start trying to compile this information. There's probably a cost of doing that. But I'm sure that the clerks would be very, very cooperative, and we could get that done. I'd be willing to talk both to CCI, which has a strong vested interest in this issue, and to DU and perhaps CU. DU has been very good about doing projects for my office as a learning experience for their students. They designed our tracer logo and have done a couple of other things like that. But I think there's some good need in this for both the accounting students and for the poli-sci students. I think together with those two, and perhaps a third element would be there's a number of foundations around the state that take an interest in this type of an issue. And I suspect we could catch a modest amount of dollars, and we might have some dollars in our office that could be used. But I think if you folks could define with some particularity the information that you would like to have, we can go forward with trying to figure out a way to get that level of particularity.
Jen?
Yes.
On that topic, Russ, I think one of the things that came up at the last meeting, and I think I brought it up, but was when we're talking about the vision of elections, one of the pressing questions that administrators have is about the capital cost. And you spoke about amortization of capital costs, and I think we were discussing it before. I mean, the system was purchased in Jefferson County in 2002 that we currently use. And right now, the amortized cost of that capital is $1 million a year. And it's significant. We tend to, once it's purchased, you know, set it aside and don't think about that. And we are moving into the end of the shelf life of our current system. And so we're going to have to look at, and we when we're thinking about these things, we're thinking 2-4 years ahead, you know, because that's the time it takes to procure, implement, train, deploy, all of that. And the questions that we have about the future and vision of elections in Colorado is, what is that system replacement going to cost in Colorado? What's the transaction cost and the variability that we have? And trying to capture, estimating, projecting the replacement cost of voting systems in Colorado. So I think that would be a good thing to look at as well if we're going to create some model of data collection, is to include that in those different schemes with the three major election systems that we provide early voting, polling place, mail ballot, with an all-mail ballot model, with some other hybrid form that we may be looking at, to because that investment, as I spoke of last time, you know, we purchased for precinct polling places in 2002, and we are at, you know, 74% permanent mail voting right now. That's going to dictate what model we implement in our county, whether if it's still polling places, does vote centers make more sense for sustainability? And when we go to move to purchase a system, we need to know, I mean, we're really going to be driving that model through that procurement process. And seeing what that picture looks like statewide would be important in what that vision is.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephanie again. I would agree with what Pam is saying. I would also offer throwback to one of the comments that you made of the cost per voter. I think in this analysis that you have to be fair as to how that number is arrived at. Consistently, again, and I'm sorry, I keep harping on this consistent adjective, but, you know, in some of the counties, when you get that bottom line number of cost and the numbers divided by either total registered voters, or it's either divided by total active voters, or it's divided by, you know, turnout, some other derivation of the larger pool of numbers. So, I mean, we have to be, again, consistent in how we are arriving at that number, because it's certainly going to affect the debate and the realities relative to the cost. Another thing that I might offer as a platform and including in this is, I don't know if the Secretary's office has ever come up with thresholds as to what constitutes what size of a county. In other words, I think it would be productive to compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges in this conversation. And to do that strategically, we have to define what constitutes the size of a small county, what constitutes the size of a medium and the size of a large county. Because certainly across those three spectrums, your costs are going to be very different, although very important relative to that particular sized county. Okay, and I don't think we've ever approached this conversation with that notion in mind.
Stephanie, this is Bernie Buescher. That's a very good point. Actually, I think both your point and Pam's point are very important. When I've looked through the detailed spreadsheets, one of the things that jumps out, and it's particularly for those very small counties that are leasing equipment or have a maintenance contract for their DREs, that contract can be in the range of $8,000 or $10,000 a year, an election, and they've got 600 people voting in the county, and nobody uses the DRE, but they still got to do it because of the requirements of a federal statute. And that's a $12 or a $15 cost per voter when you do it that analysis. Now, a similar county, same size, may have purchased the equipment and has a relatively modest maintenance fee, or has figured out a way through our office or some way to do most of that themselves. And so you really have counties that are apples and counties that are oranges, and trying to compare them gets to be truly a challenge. And I think the other point that is very, very important in this is that a number of counties are saying, just like Pam said, the useful life of our equipment is really at an end, and we have to buy new equipment. What we want to do is buy new equipment that is consistent with the state's expectations for our systems going forward, and not buy three sets of systems or two sets of systems. So if you can give us directions about how you would like to see this information cut and pasted or diced off of what the clerks have already done or further information, we'll try to get it for you so that you can make the best decisions possible.
I think I might be able to illustrate this. Going back to your question, Mr. Pelletier, how Broomfield came up with their numbers. And I'll do it, and without belaboring the point, if I could just go to one particular cost item. And this is one that, at first blush, I was not proud of, but I admitted it. It's under ballot printing. If you see my ballot printing for the polling place election or the election that we ran in November 2008 was $95,000. I'm having a little trouble reading it, I'm sorry. And yet my estimate for a mail-in ballot was less than $32,000. Mm-hmm. So you've got to ask the question, how do you have only a third of the cost for printing ballots in a mail-in ballot election? Well, let me try to explain. I did not run out of ballots anywhere in November 2008, right? And I was under express direction not to run out of ballots anywhere, whether it was through the mail. And at that time, this was the first big year that we had permanent mail-in voting. So we didn't really know. We had no history to base that on. We had multiple early voting sites. They were well stocked. We had multiple vote centers on election day. Again, very well stocked. Was this part of the fact that I could have cut from the 2008? Absolutely. In retrospect, I absolutely could have reduced that amount, but I didn't. And I was ready for it. And this goes back to that point. At $32,000 for a mail-in, the cost or the volumes are much more knowable when you have one type of voting process rather than three. And that's what it breaks down to. The way Colorado statute right now and some systems are set up, you actually have to have separate inventories for the different voting methods. You have to have a ballot that's marked absentee or mail-in for those voters. You have to have a ballot that's specific to election day. So you can't commingle the inventories. So it becomes very expensive and a very daunting task to try to inventory or stock up for each method of voting. It really drove the cost up in Broomfield. And my paranoia, quite honestly, drove the cost up significantly.
Russ, about the estimate for if it were an all mail-in ballot, that's for the printing of the ballot, but does that also include the printing of the envelope, printing of the return envelope? It's other printing costs, yes. Not just simply the ballot.
Actually, that's a good question. I'm not sure if that's... Yes, that was. If you've got the instrument that was sent out to the counties, there should be a description of the ballot printing in there, and I believe that might include the envelopes and instruction sheets.
It does.
So, yes, that is all included in that.
And I'm wondering, too, about the number of undeliverable ballots or ballots that come returned. And, I mean, you have to do the same kind of projecting of how many to produce. And I'm also wondering if, with the functionality of SCORE now, whether that will reduce the percentage of undeliverable ballots next time.
Well,
it could. It might. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. We'll have to monitor that.
I think additional mailings target that more. For example, we send the a voter information card, the inactive fail to vote mailing. We send out notices to the electors, and if it's returned mail for a mail ballot election, you categorize them as such, and you don't send the mail ballot packet for that category. So we have seen with SCORE a more distinct categorization of voters and who receives the mail ballot packet. And we've done less expensive mailings, but more frequent mailings than a ballot packet to really target that number. And I, you know, it would be an interesting analysis to see with the number of mailings that we do if it's become more efficient or less efficient with respect to cost. But it does identify whether or not, help to clarify whether or not that person's there to receive that ballot packet. And, of course, the ballot packet's more expensive than a postcard.
There's one more item on that, too, on the ballot printing. And the one thing we did not contemplate when we did this survey was mailing to inactive voters, inactive who have failed to vote. That was new in law in 2009, that requirement through 2010. So that is not included, factored into the projection for mail-in ballot costs.
I have an example of future costs trying to capture that, and I think the service centers, the cost of service centers and drop-off locations was one of them, and projecting that's difficult because this is the first year we're going to be doing that. And so we'll have some good opportunity in the primary mail ballot to sort of see that. And I know when the legislation was going through, it was a big discussion about the number of service centers, the cost of that. And I believe I testified that, you know, we're putting out these geographic service centers for our citizens, which I think is a good thing. In 2008 primary, we did just over 300 replacement ballots total throughout the entire county. And most of those were delivered by mail. We did not see those folks at our counter. So I think that's going to be a good analysis of, you know, the value of geographically distributing these, what essentially are full service polling places throughout the county in an all mail ballot construct. And then the participation, the use of them, what, you know, what our traffic is, we can pull that out of, you know, in reports and score and how that behaves in that new process, because in my county we'll do service centers for the primary mail ballot, but we're also going to do them in the general. And so it would give us some idea of that level of traffic in two different types of elections.
I would just caution about Rich Pelletier again. I would caution about the types of voters who are primary voters versus the types of voters who are general election voters, and that as we look for similarities or across primary versus general elections, we have a much more in-tuned voter who generally has updated, you know, their registration status is very current versus general election voters, particularly in a presidential year, who, you know, who are kind of all over the place, don't really think about voting until it's time to vote. So,
if I may, that's an excellent point. That's something I would caution. If we go to that point, back to your suggestion, which I think is a very good suggestion, at comparing like elections, one operated by a traditional method and one by mail-in ballot, I think we still need to take a look at a more holistic approach at it over the course, expenditures over the course of 2 years, rather than a single election. And the reason I say that is you might find in your analysis that an election where there is a traditionally low turnout, you may see a skewing of the results of what comes out cheaper or more expensive to run than you will in a greater turnout. So, you know, if you have a traditionally 14% turnout in a primary election or an odd year coordinated election, you may find that the polling place, if you plan on that historic turnout, you may find that a polling place election would be far less expensive than a mail ballot election. But when you look at a full 2 years worth of an election cycle or a four-year election cycle, that probably won't pan out.
Just on data collection for service centers, the desire to get consistency in an outcome maybe in the data collection, where it may be even more challenging. And I think those who have done this effort, Mickey and Russ in the past for other topics, have seen this, and it's not that the effort's not worth it, but for example, in our service centers, you know, stocking ballot styles for a primary, you traditionally have a lot of ballot styles for a primary. We're looking at over 900. Depending on your ability for economies of scale, you may choose to stock the ballot styles in each of the service centers. We are piloted a ballot on demand solution last year. So we're investing in a capital investment to help with the ongoing operating cost of stocking ballot styles. And we can do that because we've seen our mail ballot numbers increase so much. But in taking that approach, where another county may choose a different, and you're going to get a variable in ballot printing costs because of it. And, you know, and it's not a, I mean, without the judgment, you're just going to get a variable on that. And so, you know, I again would caution, you know, the interest in having some, you know, that consistency where it just may not be. And that data is about taking that snapshot of what it is, and trying to get the consistency in definition, I think, is the important part. How are you going to define that particular data set?
Yes, my concern is, you know, trying to identify where hidden costs might turn up later after the fact. And in going to a mail-in ballot, if it's determined, I think we'll hear from Teresa James later about the possibility that some non-stable addresses present a bigger challenge to clerks to get the ballots into their hands. And if there are added costs that will appear in order to accommodate those voters, be it, yeah, the service centers, of course, and getting them in the right locations, but also if there were the use of the National Change of Address database to find out where people really are when come election time, so that we don't spend money sending ballots to vacant apartments and things like that. So that will incur a cost that's probably not included in any of these projections, and that's probably what we have to brainstorm on.
Carol Murray again. I'd like to follow up on the and a little bit of what you just said about inactive fail to vote versus inactive non-deliverables, and I think that's a topic of discussion for the future. Do the clerks have a sense of those percentages? How many of the active voters are failed to vote versus other reasons?
Personally speaking, I do in Broomfield, but I don't have those numbers with me, and I'd hate to rely on my memory. It was pretty low.
The failed-to-vote number is pretty low.
That actually cast a ballot in the last election.
Yeah, I can tell you statewide numbers. The as a percentage of inactives, inactive failed-to-vote is a small percentage of inactives. And then as a percentage of those that voted, in 2009 we kept this number, and the percentage that actually voted that were sent who were in the category of inactive failed-to-vote was 3%.
But
the overall voting percentage for that election was 30%. So it was a low voting percentage election.
Yeah, I mean, I would the caution that we're going, you know, from I think a general election year is an entirely different creature. So.
No doubt. I have a left-hand turn question. So I'm going to throw you a curveball and ask you something completely different, Russ. One worry I have about mail ballot is that we're attaching ourselves to what I think is a dying animal, you know, which is USPS. I think the United States Postal Service is in its last dying breaths, and we're going to see the end of it in the next 10 to 15 years, especially as internet and email and so forth expand. So do we worry at all that by linking ourselves to this dinosaur, that we're sort of then going to be stuck in with an inability to transition in back into anything else that works, and we're kind of potentially with a FedEx or UPS or something like that, where our costs might be exponentially greater than they would be through USPS.
Okay, you're throwing a curve. And I'll do what I normally do when I get thrown a curve. I step out of the batter box. Again, let me go back. We did not draw a conclusion with this analysis. So if you're assigning to me the conclusion that we're going to mail in ballot elections, I'm ducking. That's your job, I guess. It's an interesting question. Tying our cart to the USPS.
Are they too big to fail? I don't know.
This is Stephanie from Denver. In any discussion relative to mail ballot elections, just based on my experience in my county with the United States Postal Service, there has to be some great conversation relative to partnership, cooperation, understanding, communication. And if those things are not settled upon prior to the state determining if it's in its best interest to go to an all-mail ballot platform, then I personally have some grave, grave concerns. Just based on my county's experience, and I can say this very truthfully and very honestly, and I haven't said anything, I won't say anything here, that I haven't said directly to the Postal Service. There are some significant challenges and hurdles. That's not to say that they can't be overcome. In my taking a tour of the postal facility and coming to understand the machinations of their business relative to nonprofit mail and elections-related mail, it's a very, very, very cumbersome process that is very deliberate and has to be done very meticulously. Otherwise, voters will not receive their ballots via the United States Postal Service. Ballots have gone missing, not to anyone's fault other than the United States Postal Service. And there are other things that have occurred relative to return addresses on both elections-related mail and on ballots themselves. Ballots being denied at the point of entry and delivery on deadline dates with no prior notification to the county that they were going to make that decision. So all of these things are very critical in this discussion. And should the United States Postal Service decide for themselves that, you know, they're in our business. You know, they've made that very, very clear to my county. They want a lot of counties' business relative to this aspect of running mail ballot elections. But I think there has to be some contingencies. I really, really do.
And if I may, too, let me couch it in these terms. The alternative, relying on voting system manufacturers, isn't a particularly rosy prospect either. We may get into that in the next topic. That's not a particularly healthy industry at this point. I love posing that. Take the lesser of two evils. That's great, especially with something as critical as elections.
But again, in the environment, I think you have to have some contingency. If you say Colorado's an all-mail ballot state, what happens if there is some type of event that causes the Postal Service to have to shut down their bulk mail facility? Because they very candidly shared in their conversation with us that nothing goes in the post office and nothing comes out of there when they're doing an investigation relative to some type of threat that they have come upon. So imagine that in the environment of an all-mail ballot election in the Monday or the Friday before the Postal Service has made that decision and you've got thousands of ballots sitting at a particular bulk mail facility. That's a real concern. I have enough trouble sleeping already. I do too.
but you know, I will. I understand what you're saying, that is an ugly picture you're painting there of that day. But also understand that when we're looking at a mail ballot election, we're talking a greater time period. What are we talking now? 22 days between mailing and election day. And if we look at just a polling place, election day polling place election, you're putting everything on one day, all your systems working without any opportunity to recover. With mail, at least you have some days. And I'm not trying to sell mail ballots here. I'm just saying you need to think about the advantage of the multiple day time frame. You may want to look at, you know, we have this triad right now of how voters can cast ballots in Colorado, either on election day at a polling location, early voting in person, or through the mail. Well, early voting in person, in a general election, you open up 2 weeks prior. You have multiple times. If you have a catastrophic failure of your systems, the first day you open early voting, it hurts, but it's recoverable. Mm-hmm. You have more days. So, sleep easy tonight, Secretary. Everything's fine.
Three little anecdotes. I remember November's election, 2008, Friday before the election, going to the mail facility here in Denver, the one that's open latest, and there were some election workers from Denver with a whole cart full of next-day delivery envelopes going out, trying to get to voters by Monday, and the postal clerk was saying, well, we're going to do our best, hopefully you don't run into weather. And I do know now the Postal Service is considering eliminating Saturday delivery, which is something that election workers or we'd have to get an exemption of that and get people delivering on Saturday before an election, it sounds like. I'll also remember when I lived in Argentina, land of 1,000 strikes, there was one time when the postal workers went on strike, but they came to work. And they burned 6 million letters between 8 a.m. and noon. And they got their raise at 1 o'clock. But things like that happen, too.
Is this a good time to start talking about poll worker stories?
Does anybody have anything more for us?
Were we going to have Russ back to talk about the state of voting systems? And since he is a member on the national committee, I just don't. If we were going to save that for a future date and have him back to open up that conversation, that'd be great. Or should we take our pot shots now?
We could do either. Russ, if you're prepared to talk about that subject, we can talk about it. You touched on it a bit, but we can always save it as well.
Well, you know, I based on our conversation, Judd, I came in with the notion of giving the commission an overview of activities going on at the EAC, the Election Systems Commission, and the Technical Guidelines Development Committee. It was an overview. If there are specific questions, I could certainly come back and put more effort in particular aspects. Your call. I'm at the beck and call of the commission.
Well, let's move on today, and we'll call you if that topic becomes important in the future.
As my last presentation did, I'm sure this one will leave many questions too. This one probably more. In fact, I would dare say that I probably have more questions right now than most of you do about what's going on at the EAC. Quick background for me: in 2005, the Colorado Clerks Association appointed me as the local election official representative to the Standards Board for the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. The Help America Vote Act established the Election Assistance Commission, and with it, two advisory boards, the Board of Advisors and the Standards Board. The Board of Advisors is smaller in number but wider in scope as far as membership. The Standards Board consists of a local election representative and a state election representative from each of the states and territories in the U.S. So it's a fairly large committee. Within that committee, I was appointed as their representative to the Technical Guidelines Development Committee. I figure eventually, one of these days, I'm going to get appointed to enough committees that it'll actually pay, but until that point, I'm here doing goofy presentations. The Technical Guidelines Development Committee was formed by HAVA. It was created by HAVA to essentially draft the voluntary guidelines that the EAC is considering adopting at a national level, at a federal level. What the EAC will quickly tell you is those are voluntary guidelines, that each state can adopt any or all of those guidelines. Some of you may remember that just recently, I believe it was last year, the Colorado legislation determined it best to sever the requirement that Colorado voting systems must be certified at the federal level. So we can consider the certification process at the federal level in Colorado, but we're not required to only use systems that are certified by the Election Assistance Commission. The EAC adopted what's called the Voluntary Voting System Guide 1.0, and I'm going to use that convention, naming convention. You may have heard of it if you've been involved in this. It's the 2005 VVSG. The EAC is backing away with labeling their guidelines by year simply because of the connotation that if you buy a system that's been approved as standards in 2005, well, what about 2010? Where are you today? But in fact, that's the most current set of guidelines available. So they've gone to the more common nomenclature of 1.0. That was adopted on December 13, 2005, with an effective date of December 13, 2007. Systems currently submitted to the EAC for testing and certification are tested against the VVSG 2001 standards, or 1.0 standards, I apologize. During the work on the next iteration of the voluntary voting system, and I hate to do this, but I'm going to get into some acronyms. It's VVSG is what we call it. It's much easier to, it rolls right off the tongue. During the EAC's work on the next iteration, the VVSG 2.0, they ran into some pretty significant issues. But at the time, and the TGDC had developed a new draft. In reviewing that new draft, they saw elements of that that could be backported into the 1.0 guidelines. They felt somewhat easily and greatly enhanced the 1.0 guidelines. The 1.0 guidelines that are currently in existence are in a great degree a rehash of the 2002 voting system standards that was adopted by the Federal Election Commission. The EAC was under a terribly tight time frame in getting these passed by Congress was breathing down their necks, so it was really pretty much a rehash of the 2002 standards. I'm sure the EAC would cringe to hear it characterized that way, but in truth. So they looked at what the work going on in the next iteration of the VVSG, the 2.0, and found some things in there, such as testing protocols, that could easily be ported back into the 1.0 guidelines. And they started working on the 1.1 version, okay? Now, that has gone through several gyrations. It has gone through public review and comment. It has gone through both the Standards Board and the Board of Advisors for comment. They expect to have it adopted by July of this year. Now, there are a couple of major policy questions that have yet to be answered. Number one, will it also have a delayed effective date as the 1.0 did? 1.0 came into effect with a two-year delay before it became effective. I haven't gotten an answer out of the EAC whether or not they're going to do that this go around. Second is, can you run concurrent sets of guidelines? In other words, would the EAC be willing to test systems submitted against the 1.0 guidelines and systems submitted to the 1.1? They haven't determined that yet. It's a very critical policy issues the EAC has to answer before they release the 1.1. Work on the VVSG 2.0 continues. As I said before, numerous issues arose from the reviews of the current draft. Essentially, the EAC took several of those major issues and threw them back to the TGDC, the Technical Guidelines Development Commission, said these need further research, get into this, come back with recommendations, let's enhance the 2.0. It is a large document, some 700 pages, lots of technical aspects to it, but it also has a lot of human aspects to it. Right now, the TGDC is working on four particular areas. UOCAVA voting. How is that to be done? And that's not only driven by the AC's desire to get the VVSG 2.0 in action, it's also by the recent federal act that was passed that's pushing UOCAVA voting. They're looking very hard at internet voting, electronic voting using the internet for overseas voters. Accessibility and usability. I see Ms. Gross here. I'm sure this is going to be highly interesting to her. It's the TGDC, let me take a step back. The TGDC works very closely with NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. NIST has been exploring usability and accessibility for several years now. And they're underway, and they're now, the TGDC is all new members, essentially. I was appointed last year. My first meeting was in December, and it's the only one. And I'm having to practically relearn everything they've done for the last 4 years. And they're thrilled, the folks in this. They love having to go back over everything again. The third element that they're working in is auditability of systems. I know a lot of you are very interested in how systems are can be audited. Along with that is software independence. How can a system provide the tools for elections administrators and the public, the voting public, to be assured that their systems are working properly, not having to rely on the tabulation software? And marginal marks. That one just seems so trivial, almost. But yet it's an amazing topic. It's using an optical scan ballot. How do you deal with stray marks on an optical ballot? And it's they refer to it as marginal marks. I think it's a great name for a rock band or something, Marginal Marks and the Mysticals. But I'm involved in the auditability and marginal marks efforts right now, and it's having been involved with optical scan systems since 97. Marginal marks is very close to my heart. But they run into these problems with the 2.0 version, and they couldn't overcome them. They had not done enough research on that draft to satisfy the critics and the manufacturers and the folks that with an interest in the game. So they've thrown it back to the TGDC, and that's where we're at now, essentially digging deeper in some of the major issues that took place in the 2.0 draft. There's probably another 2 to 3 years of effort before we see the EAC approach adopting the 2.0 standards. And that came from the EAC. They were willing to share that with me. They don't expect adoption for another 3 years. So, Clerk Anderson, that kind of goes to your question prior to the meeting, how sustainable are our systems? I don't know. It may be another 3 years before we have another set of standards. That could be a good thing. I will step back and say the 1.0 version was developed greatly in mind current technologies and current systems. The 2.0 version is not. It is not fettered by current systems, current technology. It is essentially trying to envision the next generation of voting systems. So it is a much more difficult process, trying to know the unknown. Hopefully they will address battery life of laptops, too, when they get to that. So with that said, are there any questions concerning what's going on at the federal level?
I'm curious, Russ, if the new the plan for 1.1 is going to be all prospective, so not the existing technical expertise, but expanded upon technical expertise, what vendors do they expect will be around to do that? I mean, at this point, the vendors are struggling, I gather.
The EAC has taken great pains to stay away from that issue. They want to establish guidelines that are completely independent from any existing manufacturers. Interestingly enough, the TGDC just added an additional member, not an additional, they have four. There's 15 people on the commission, on the committee. There are 4 seats available for selection that are not particular representatives of any, like the Standards Board or the Board of Advisors. They are 4 experts, technical experts that have some interest or some involvement in the elections field. One of them, for the first time, was a representative from a manufacturer. So that's some look at that as a setback. Others look at it as it's about time. Here we have federal guidelines being developed without a representative of the current industry. But they really had to try to underscore the point, try to keep an arm's length between manufacturers and the guidelines, which has had mixed results, quite honestly. So as far as what their prognosis is any are any existing manufacturers going to meet these new deadlines, going to be able to, or new guidelines, I don't know. I don't think that's even on their radar. If you listen to the manufacturers, there's no way they can do it. But
and is the EAC expanding their purview at all, or are they sticking straight to DREs? They're really only doing voting machines, or are they going to go to signature verification?
That's just like this. The group I'm in, we're looking at marginal marks. That's optical scan.
Yeah, that's true.
They're also looking at the UOCAVA effort. They're looking at internet voting.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to explore the accessibility issue with internet voting. If it doesn't make more sense to go that avenue, if someone with physical disabilities has at their home the assistive methods with their own PC, why not utilize that versus forcing them to come to a polling place to vote on some Rube Goldberg device mm-hmm. that may or may not cater their particular needs?
Mm-hmm.
So that's their thinking in that regard.
And has there been any discussion about signature verification?
Not that I'm aware of.
Because that seems like if we're going to all mail, let's you know pull this back into the last discussion. If we found ourselves 5 years from now an all mail ballot state, it seems like bubble scanners and signature verification is where our election electronics and technology are. So. Is there any will on the EAC to take
one of the things the EAC has stayed away from, Judd, is procedures. And signature verification, unless you bring in the technology piece, the automated right. signature verification, it's really a procedure that stems from state statute and election officials' policies. So they have, with their guidelines, they really have geared into the systems themselves.
But you were getting to the automated part, right?
Yeah. So see, I mean, one of the things that, as I understand it, and I don't have a great deal of experience with signature verification, but some of the machines that they do now are purely manual, and some are automated to some degree. And the next iteration will be a fully automated system in which you can literally run these things through, and it captures the signature and compares it automatically to the existing signature on file. And based on the point designation that they can do, that they've set up the computer system to do, they could verify without ever doing an eyeball on it. That seems like a big part of voting.
Let me share this with you. There were two other topics that were kind of on the periphery, too, that the TGDC determined not to explore at this point. That was ballot on demand and electronic poll books.
Hmm.
Both research topics have been put on hold.
Sure. And so this would be in line with those.
It would be in line with those, right.
Okay.
Now, one thing I did before my screen went blank, I did have one more bullet point for the AC. One of the things they're doing now that may be an interest to the group, they've just completed a project called the Elections Operation Assessment. The idea there was to develop a generic voting system, models, analyze the models to identify threats, use the results of the analysis to develop a threat assessment tool, and then use that assessment tool for NIST and for the EAC in evaluating benefits and costs of proposed security requirements for the BVSG 2.0. What I heard NIST say a couple of years ago in testimony was, here we're going through all of this brain damage trying to develop guidelines, security guidelines for systems, and we don't even know the threats. We have not clearly identified what the threats are for these systems. So the EAC backed off and said,
give us, let's develop a tool to identify those threats and to better be able to identify a cost-benefit analysis. What threats are more likely, most likely, absolutely likely that we need to address our resources or point our resources to? So that's something that they're keeping amongst themselves, but I've had conversations with them. I was on a committee that actually reviewed the assessment tool, and it's very complicated, but I think if you get some people that don't understand it, it would be a wonderful thing for states to have access to be able to understand. Like when you guys are discussing mail ballots, that's one of the voting modules that they have put forth and have identified risks to it. And so you have the ability to sit in a group like this, and you guys, using your intuition and your experience, you throw in variables and decide variables, and this thing mixes them up and spits out a formula for you or an algorithm that says, or results, a numeric result that says, this risk is 3 times more likely to happen than this risk. This is what you need to keep your eye on. So it's...
Just a note on the UOCAVA voting. I think 2008 was a year when Colorado was one of the pilot projects for foreign servicemen, armed service people voting in this way. But in the rule that Mike Kaufman adopted, guiding that, coming from the Department of Defense on this, they required that any GI voting via internet waive their right to a secret ballot because of the inherent vulnerabilities of that method of voting. I think it came out of a threat assessment report on internet voting that NIST put out a couple years ago. And so to answer the question, Faith, why someone might prefer to go down to the precinct and vote rather than stay and do it on their PC, they too might have to waive their right to a secret ballot. Maybe that's not important to them, but for some it is.
Yeah, and I would throw out that the Department of Defense is sponsoring more of those trials this year, and Colorado has volunteered to be a part of that, and we don't know yet where we're going to fall and what our role will be in that process, but we're in those discussions.
There was a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and someone named Richard Clark has proposed that we do a simulated internet election and invite all the white hat and black hat hackers to do what they can. Again, another real thorough threat assessment should probably be utilized before going anywhere close to that.
Well, fortunately, we don't know who Richard Clark is, and so we don't need to worry about him.
I'll send you the article.
Just kidding. Are there any other questions for us?
Well, while we're on the topic of internet voting, I guess I would like some clarification about giving up a secret ballot. You do that when you email a ballot, because obviously the email is received and someone sees it. But in true internet voting, which I think we're talking about, where people vote and it goes into a system, no one sees that and it's still secret. So you're talking about email voting.
Yeah, right? I think the current method is they'll get a they have to scan a paper ballot and get it into a print a paper ballot, vote on it, scan it, make it into a PDF before it's sent through the federal, that one agency. So I think that's the way it's done currently. I don't know if there's any change proposed to that.
Yeah, right now there's 3 components to the UOCAVA voting. There's the request the ballot, there's the deliver the ballot, and there's the return the ballot. And so what the EAC is trying to do is determine whether you have one system that fits all 3 of those needs, that satisfies all 3 of those components, or is there a hybrid system available that part of it is you have to return it manually, but you can request it electronically or whatever configuration they can come up with. But I think you're right. Right now, if you're returning it via fax or email, you do have to have that affidavit that relinquishes your right to a secret ballot.
That's not what we would call
internet voting.
Voting, yeah. So I think we need to maybe come up with our definitions as a group when we're talking about internet voting versus facilitating
electronic transmission
of a ballot. Yeah.
It's been interesting dealing with NIST on this, because NIST has come out and pretty much said, we don't believe the internet in its current state is securable to the level of voting. And the EAC is under pressure from Congress to come up with some electronic means, which some are interpreting as internet voting, and they're trying to get NIST to get off the dime and at least develop guidelines or help the TGDC. And so this meeting I was at, it was really interesting, this meeting I was at in December, you had the director of NIST saying, you have to tell us what you want, saying this to the TGDC members. And we had the federal election officer from the EAC saying, you need to tell them what you want. And you got 14 new members on this committee, and we're like, well, what do we want? So it was just this kind of a struggle back and forth. So hopefully we're going to start making some progress there. But it doesn't come without caveats.
So, and I can also speak to that. The electronic transfer is something we've done for the last couple of election cycles. It's something Colorado was at the forefront of. There's lots of states that don't even do this. So when it comes to MOVE compliance, which is the new military voting statute, which was passed last September, October, Colorado is really in very good shape. We're in much better shape than other states. There is this movement to go to a more internet-based voting, and it actually is an internet voting. That's one of the options that the military is considering for this trial that's going to happen this election cycle. And we have our preference, because we've looked at SCIDL, and everybody votes, or everyone votes, I'm not sure what, but we've looked at a couple of the different major ones, and we know which one that we think would best fit our needs. We'll see if they come up with the same ones that we do. FVAP obviously has been on the forefront of this and kind of leverages where a lot of this goes. Regardless, we're probably going to be one of the test cases. We've already talked to El Paso County, and Bob Baylink is very much on board with giving this a try. We fully anticipate that we're going to be right there. Whether or not it's successful and whether it's something that we go forward with after that, we'll know more. But at this point, as a trial, we're prepared to give it a try. So, actually, what may very well happen is we switch to mail in the next couple of years, and then when the Postal Service dies out, we go internet.
Right,
you know?
Internet.
It's just, we'll just transition right in. Yeah, that's right. That was sarcasm for those on the internet there.
Another seamless transition in the elections world, right?
That's right. Well, with that, why don't we take a little break, and then we'll come back, and Teresa James will do her presentation. Thanks a lot, Rush. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
How about, it's 5 till 3 right now, how about 5 after 3? Great.
You are permitted to mute your...
Thank you.